into positions of hopelessness and helplessness. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America. No, 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 not God Bless America. God damn America, that's in the Bible, for killing innocent people. God damn America, for treating our citizens as less than human. God damn America, as long as she tries to act like she is God and she is supreme.
Oh, fuck, it's St. Patrick's Day, isn't it?
Where you are, technically.
Oh, yeah, because it's like midnight where you are.
We're recording at the end of another New York St. Patrick's Day.
Congratulations on making it through.
I made it. Wore green and alienated everyone around me, actually, by playing the Pogues all day.
Uh-huh.
As well as the Coors. I didn't know they were Irish. A lot of bands I didn't know that were Irish, and apparently there's a good Irish song about being a cowgirl or a cowboy. I want to be a cowboy. It's like, I thought it would be the Kid Rock song, but it's a different song from that.
Are you talking about Thin Lizzy?
C-Matt. I want to be a cowboy baby. Which I looked at it, I thought it would be a cover of the Kid Rock, but it's a totally different song. It's by a woman of Irish nationality, and it's very good, I have to say.
That's really weird. Did it come before or after Kid Rock?
After, I think that's safe to say.
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah. It's just parallel writing. Because that sounds like exactly how he says it.
I think it might be one of those things where it's like they just used the name self-consciously, knowing that it had been used before, but they did... Maybe they let it inspire, but they did their own thing.
Okay.
And I appreciate it.
Is Thin Lizzy Irish? Am I making that up?
Yeah. No, they are. They are. And a bunch of bands that I'm all forgetting. There's a Spotify playlist. Yeah.
They have a really good song about being a cowboy. What is up with Irish people wanting to be cowboys?
I mean, I think a lot of people look at America and see cowboys and want to emulate it. We're one of the few countries where they have cowboys. I mean, I know they're in other places, but it's kind of like an American thing. There's like in Poland, people would like to dress up as cowboys. I know there's like some country music out there. But you know what is also very American is St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
It's not really that much of a thing in Ireland. And if it is, they wear blue, apparently. They don't wear green or something.
They're fucking
like that.
Blue? Or is it yeah. Orange? I heard it was orange. There's like a weird green-orange thing with them.
Well, yeah, there's the nationalists versus the unionists. And the unionists are orange, which is funny why the Chicago Bears got in trouble a couple years ago because they did, you know, in Chicago, I don't know if they do this every year, but they have done it. They make the river or the lake, whatever the body of water in Chicago that goes under that bridge, they make it green for St. Patty's Day, but the Chicago Bears did a little spin on that and made it orange to represent the Bears' colors. And obviously, that has connotations if you're from Ireland or if you're of Irish extraction. And so people were not happy about that because they made it sound like they are supportive of a divided Ireland and perhaps even think they should be suffering under the yoke of the crown.
Well, also, if you make a river orange, it just looks like it's dirty. Like it doesn't look like it's like artificially created color. It just looks like it's fucking muddy.
Green doesn't make it look great either, but
at least it looks like the Gowanus.
Yeah, right.
It's always St. Patrick's Day at the Gowanus Canal.
That's a good spin to put on that swamp.
It's
do
green.
People still do green bagels? I remember that as a kid.
Never heard of that. That's some crazy Midwest really? Shit I've never heard of.
Well, this was, I think they probably did them. This was when I was in Virginia, and we would get green bagels every St. Patrick's Day, and then make something else green, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah. Which,
that was the most fun. But you know who doesn't celebrate St. Patrick's Day? Seamus McKiernan. We're now 10 years out from one of my least favorite op-eds from 2014 entitled Why I Don't Celebrate St. Patrick's Day for the Huffington Post. And if you read it now, this is gives you an idea of the current state of media, perhaps compared to the 2010s. Says this post was published on the now closed HuffPost contributor platform. Contributors control their own work and posted, emphasis on the TID, it's past tense, they posted freely to our site. And if you do need to flag this entry as abusive, send us an email. So this is, they're just like almost completely amputated this section of the website from HuffPo. But okay. There was a time in which people could write essays and get paid for them. It seems like it was a blast to be a freelance writer in the 2010s. I definitely around this time, I think I wanted to be one and probably submitted to places, but I started getting published in the wrong decade.
Yeah, I did a little bit of it back then, and it was cool, but it was still a fake job because you would work very hard and write something and get paid $50 for it and then have to do like a mountain of paperwork in order to make it all legal and stuff and get paid. And then people would put in their Twitter bio, like, I'm a writer at the Huffington Post and I live in Manhattan. And you'd go, okay, that's not how you paid for that apartment. You didn't do like 100 of those a week or whatever.
Do you get to stay at Arianna Huffington's apartment? Is that what the job entitles you to?
Yeah.
She's got a giant penthouse where she staffs her entire
but office. It's remember, like serfdom, though. Like, you have to live with her. It's fucked up.
I would be into that, not going to lie. They used to have like a show on HuffPo. They've downscaled. HuffPo is scaled down. They used to have it like a almost like a TV show. Like the level production quality of like a cable news network, and they would interview people, and that's gone by the wayside. But anyway, we can't. I mean, maybe some of this is for the better because this is very much of the era of like contrarian sort of pop culture takes. This particular one is an Irish American searching for a reason to be offended. Which we love taking any opportunity to do. They don't present themselves that often, or if they do, they are stupid in this case. But this guy, Seamus McKiernan, writes about how he doesn't celebrate St. Patrick's Day, even though he's a dual citizen and his grandfather founded the Irish American Cultural Institute, but he actively avoids St. Patrick's Day. Not because he's against having a good time, not because he's ashamed of his Irish heritage, but because he's worried St. Patrick's Day has become a farce, a celebration of cartoonish symbols of Irish culture that minimize, dilute, and demean what it means to be Irish. Wrapped in an excuse to drink debaucherously, which is not a, I don't know if that's a word, itself a stereotype long used to keep Irish immigrants down. The holiday is so devoid of culture that it may as well be grouped with fake holidays like SantaCon. Just switch red garb for green. Seamus, you're just describing the concept of a holiday.
Yeah.
This is every holiday.
It's all true. But it's like, yeah, SantaCon is also not a holiday. That's a thing that happens in relation to Christmas.
Right. Yes, and there's St. Patrick's Day parades in relation to, I mean, I guess what he's getting at is there's no essential experience of St. Patrick's Day. It's all just kind of like wearing green. But that's become the fun of it, right? In America, and again, it's an American holiday. It's for Irish Americans. It's for people like me who still have some, you know, we have crossed the Rubicon where our ethnicity has become fun, right? It's fun to mock it and make a caricature out of it. I'm very lucky because I only have two ethnicities, and they are both eminently mockable, and you know, they lend themselves to caricature, and I'm okay with that. That I have that dream for everybody. Norwegian, you know, I cheer for a team that's like Nordic face. They have like a, if history had gone a different way, arguably the Vikings mascot and logo would be offensive, but it didn't go that way, and so it's fun. As is wearing green and pinching people they don't wear green and annoying your friends by playing the Cranberries. And, you know, if you're into that, drinking. I don't participate in the debaucheristics of the holiday because I'm like in my 30s now, but it's fun and people get a kick out of it and you should let them, Seamus. So stop being a scold. Yeah, apparently the guy St. Patrick wore blue. And and also it was in Ireland, the holiday, there wasn't any drinking. It was supposed to be a dry holiday. The guy also may not have been Irish. The shamrock is not even a popular Irish symbol, but instead it's supposed to be the harp. So, but that's not as fun. But again, you know, stimulation, simulacrum, whatever. It's a new thing. It's things evolve, they morph, they change, and have fun with it. And it's been 10 years. I hope Seamus came around and is at least wearing green. It's like one thing to not, you know, go out and go to the parade, but to like wear all black on St. Patrick's Day, I think is a little much.
I got into a Twitter back and forth with the Horror Vanguard people like a year ago because I was watching Leprechaun and we planned on doing an episode and it just sort of never happened. But my take on the Leprechaun movies is kind of what you're talking about with like, you can, it's benign and you can mock Irish people now. Uh-huh. Is if that had not happened, the Leprechaun would be like a gruesome minstrel type image.
Yeah.
But because it did, it's like a funny thing now. And I think that's why the Leprechaun horror films are a little bit, that's where the horror comes from, is like a little uncanny with like what's going on with caricaturing a, like a race like that. Yeah. It's like subliminal or a subconscious rather. It's in the background. Mm-hmm. But that's what's so great about like comedy, you know, when it becomes like benign like that, it makes you mm-hmm. able to fuck around with ideas like that and joke around. No one gets offended over a Leprechaun joke. Come on, you can't. You're fine now.
Yeah. I mean, if it's though, I will say English people cannot make fun of the Irish. I will
there, yes, true.
In the sand there. Because it's still fucking, you know, they're still controlling Britain anyways, controlling part of Ireland, and it should be reunified, which could happen this year, according to Star Trek. You know, and we still got most of the year left, 2024, you know, and this is one of those years where every 4 years, it's you got a lot of shit happening in the same year, right? We had 2016... Trump, what else happened? Princess Leia died. It was a big year. 2020, all that shit happens. You also have like every 4 years, the Olympics, leap day. In 2020 is a pandemic. There's always something crazy in the mix there every 4 years. And I think this year, I'm hoping it is Irish reunification.
You threw in leap day with the pandemic?
Yeah, well,
those are of equal magnitude to you.
Well, I'm just saying, like, automatically you got presidential election, Olympics, and leap day all in the same year every 4 years, and usually it escalates and there's another crazy thing.
Are you implying that leap day was a global disaster, that it ruined people's lives, divided the country?
I mean, as we talked about, there are people who are eight when they're really, you know, four times eight, 32.
That's right.
And that's ruined their lives to be born on leap day. We got to get that figured out. But Biden is Irish-American, and he definitely buys into this, that the identity, right? And I have a theory there's like an inverse relationship between like how Irish you are and how much you talk about it, and people who are like fully Irish, like, you know, my family, like people never talked about being Irish. They were like, we're not Irish, we're American. Yeah. It's my grandparents. And then little by little, you know, my mom got slightly more into the genealogy and stuff. And now I love, you know, talking about being Irish. And Biden is the same way. He's like, what, the 1/15th Irish or something like that. And he loves to complain about the Brits and even romanticizes the Molly Maguires, who were not nigh turn of phrase, but were considered terrorists by some people of English origin.
Does he complain about the British?
Yeah, in the White House, he was given some speech, and I forget, it was a modern day situation that was definitely not Israel-Palestine, but it could have been, just in terms of that situation. Obviously, he would not draw the parallel, but he said, this is just like, you know, back in during the potato famine when people were dying because of what the Brits were doing, is what he said. He also jokingly refused to give an interview to BBC once because, like, BBC, I'm Irish. But yeah, there's like some lore in the Biden family about how they don't like English people. But in the White House today, because it's St. Patrick's Day, he sits down with the Taoiseach, which is like an official in Ireland. And, you know, this is one thing I've been thinking about with like Israel too. There's like a president and a prime minister, and it's very confusing. Ireland, they have a president, and they also have a Taoiseach, which is another word for
Taoiseach.
Yeah, I don't know where it comes from.
I thought
from.
You said a siege, which is, I just watched the new Dune, which is incredibly good. And there's that's the town that the Fremen live in the underground. It's called a siege.
Okay, maybe it's related to, maybe they cop that from Ireland.
It kind of might be, because it seems like Frank Herbert, the guy who wrote Dune, was like doing lots of metaphors about lots of actual historical shit. Mm. I could see there being some Irish shit in the Fremen, because they're the colonized.
Okay.
Irish would have a still suit, but it's beer. It puts beer out of your system and back into it. You know what a still suit is? It's because they live in the desert. They wear a suit that like captures all the moisture and then like recycles it into their like system. It'd be that, but with Jameson.
Oh.
Lots of fun lore at Dune. Dune's really good.
Okay. I'll have to, I don't know if I should start from the Lynch Dune or if I can just skip right ahead to.
Well, they're all the same story.
Right.
So you don't have to like watch all of them to get a chronological thing.
Yeah. I just don't know if I should fully take in the entire experience. Watch. I know Yoderowski tried to make one. There's a whole doc about that.
The documentary about it's really good. It never got made.
Yeah, I want to see that, but at the White House, Leo Varadkar, pardon me if I'm butchering that pronunciation, but he is visiting purely because it's St. Patrick's Day, and I doubt they really thought this through that much. I mean, someone in the White House, I'm sure, expected there to be some mention of Gaza, because there is longstanding solidarity between the Palestinian and Irish people. Varadkar, giving his speech, says, Mr. President, I don't know if I should do the accent or not. Mr. President, as you know, the Irish people are deeply troubled about the catastrophe that's unfolding before our eyes in Gaza. And when I travel the world, leaders often ask me why the Irish people have such empathy for the Palestinian people. The answer is simple. We see our history in their eyes, which is a moving statement. You know, it's a brief thing to, you know, a bit of a brief selection, but I think is an important thing to mention. And I think a welcome reminder that history is not going to look fondly upon Joe Biden for this genocide that's ongoing. And he even continued, said, the people of Gaza desperately need food, medicine, and shelter, and most especially, they need the bombs to stop. This has to be on both sides, the hostages brought home, and humanitarian relief allowed in. So there is like an impetus for Varadkar to make this statement coming from Ireland. The Irish people, the population, wants him to do stuff like this and you know, lobby the American president to appeal to President Biden, who is, as he calls him, a courageous Irish American, and says it's about the promises we make to our children who deserve a chance to succeed, the promises we make to each other, the sacred promise to work for a better future for all. Those are the words of Bo Biden. He turns it around on him. He's quoting Biden's dead son right in front of him as a plea to stop killing Palestinian people.
Wow, damn.
Yeah. And, you know, there's massive outcry in Ireland. There, I just shared today, there was a, in Belfast, in Northern Ireland, there was like a mural of Genocide Joe and people from the three main parties in Ireland proper telling Mr. Biden that he's not welcome. Ireland says no to Genocide Joe. And there's like there's from SF, FF, and FG. So Sinn Féin, Fine Gael, and Fine Gael, which are the three main parties. And each of the figures are holding up a four-leaf clover, which suggests to me that maybe clovers are somewhat of a big deal in Ireland. Maybe not as big a deal as we think they are in America, but they still have them there. They're part of the iconography, Mr. Seamus. But one of the one on the left, Sinn Féin, this has been kind of bubbling up for a couple of years now, and leading to some sort of hopeful hypothesizing that the Star Trek, if people aren't familiar with that, there's a Star Trek episode where they mention the great Irish reunification of 2024.
Oh.
They say that in Star Trek. So a couple, was that like a year ago or so, maybe longer, where Sinn Féin did fairly well, better than expected in the elections. There's been, you know, speculation that could happen because they are the Irish Nationalist Party. They are at one point, they were essentially the political wing of the IRA, and they want reunification. The way they have been able to get in, you know, higher favor with the people of Ireland more recently is actually centering economic issues like housing. Which is a serious problem, I mean, everywhere, but especially in Ireland. And so they're finally kind of focusing on those bread and butter issues, and whether or not that leads to a one united Ireland is difficult to say, probably not, or at least not anytime soon, but, it'll be interesting to see. And, it would be interesting to see too, what, you know, Mr. Biden, what he wants his legacy to be on that, because I could see like everything's going to shit foreign policy wise. Maybe his like one saving grace is that he like forces the UK to pull out of Northern Ireland and just like give it to the Irish people. Maybe he puts boots on the ground, levies sanctions, all that stuff. That'd be fun. He's not going to do it, but come on, at least go out on a high note.
Yeah, that'd be cool. As long as we're still on the topic of Ireland, did you mention something about them having their own Power Rangers earlier?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I found this out last night, actually. I was at a club video, which is a great, like, every few months in Brooklyn, there's like they show a bunch of comedy shorts at this big get-together. And there was a short, and I wish I could remember the name of the person who did it, but there's a short that referenced a TV show called The Mystic Knights of Tir na n'Og. And I was like, oh, that's weird. Is that, like, did they make this up for the short? But no, lo and behold, apparently there was a show in the 90s, a spinoff of Power Rangers, but the Power Rangers were Irish.
It's like, all the Green Ranger?
They do all like the same karate and stuff as the Power Rangers, but at least in the first episode, which I watched, they don't have like the suits aren't as much of a part of it. But maybe that changes in subsequent episodes.
Well, that was like a genre of show in Japan, and it has something to do with some cultural thing that happened in Japan. You'd have these like shows about these teams of like kind of superhero-y type people, but they do all the like synchronized, you know, hand motions and stuff. Like there's like these specific things to it. And then Power Rangers is like, they took just like the footage from one of those and then like wrote a bunch of American teen drama bullshit into it. That's why you would notice when you watch an episode of Power Rangers, the scenes where they're fighting are completely separate from the scenes where they're like at high school or whatever, because the scenes where they're fighting are just a Japanese TV show that it's like just swinging to or whatever.
Yeah.
So like, I'm wondering, is there some weird crossover in Irish culture and whatever the fuck was happening in Japan that made all these like weird superhero guy wears a football helmet kind of characters?
Maybe, but like from what I read, they filmed this in Ireland.
I mean,
they used Irish actors, I think, including the fight scenes.
Well, what I mean is like, is there like, is it a cultural parallel? Because you know, have you seen that show Shogun?
Yeah, I started watching it with my girlfriend.
It's really good. It's it is not just Japanese Game of Thrones, although it kind of is. But like when you're watching it, you're like, it, you know, watching like feudal Japanese stuff, you do sort of just sit there and go, huh, this is kind of the exact same thing as knights and like fiefdoms and kings and stuff like that, and it just with like a different aesthetic. And you kind of wonder like, all right, well, does that just happen in every culture? Like in a vacuum, do you just drop humans and eventually they like create a version of knighthood and like shit like that?
Yeah.
So like, I guess what I'm arguing is that this is the Irish, or that you're watching that happen in Ireland, right, on some level, but it's like their version of a samurai, which is why Thin Lizzy would sing about cowboys, because that's also similar.
There you go.
That's why everybody around the globe loves cowboys, because it's like a weird parallel, you know. Samurai is also kind of like cowboys.
True. The cool thing about that show is you got Japanese, Brits, and the Portuguese kind of in one sort of sticky situation.
It's real weird. Nobody ever thinks about them.
Yeah, they used to be huge. They used to be basically like, you know, Catholics. The Catholic Church was like heavily Portuguese, and there's a whole subplot about the Catholics trying to take over Japan. But there's some weird characters in this show, which I think it was like, probably was on Irish TV maybe, but it was like for an American audience, and they do have suits. I should say they're like bejeweled. They have like suits of armor and stuff. It's not quite like the Power Rangers helmets, unfortunately, which is, I wish it was, but there's some weird characters here. There's a dude named, there's some monsters, one of which is just called Giant Spider, and they have to fight. In the first episode, there's like a really, you know, in retrospect, poorly done digital skeleton who a guy fights, and it's hard to take seriously. Oh, but the one, probably the scariest sounding one, I think, is the Worm of Woe. One of the monsters.
And what? Sounds cool.
Yeah, according to Wikipedia, the plot line there is to ensure that King Conchobar and King Fanvara don't fulfill a prophecy where they have to sit on each other's thrones for a day, Queen Maeve unleashes the Worm of Woe upon Tirnanog. It managed to disarm Rohan and Ivar of their weapons and corner them, and then another person distracts it while they grab their weapons and armor up, and then they're able to destroy the Worm of Woe, which I'm going to Google search. Maybe that looks interesting. But while I do that, speaking, another Worm of Woe is this 2024 election, folks.
It is a Worm of Woe, isn't it?
Worm
really?
Of Woe. Yeah, that's from episode to episode covering this thing. Feels like a Worm of Woe. And I think we don't do it too much. We take breaks from it, and which you have to do because it's very depressing and not a lot of things to be hopeful about. And that's okay. That's how most presidential elections are. But I did want to just kind of highlight some of the, speaking of Biden, and this is related to what's going on in Gaza. He is getting really pissy with his staff. There's a reporter. This is an NBC. The reporter asks Andrew Bates, who is a White House spokesman, about Biden's falling poll numbers, specifically in Michigan and Georgia, and even more specifically about the Gaza war, his handling of that. And Andrew Bates says, President Biden makes national security decisions based on the country's national security needs alone. No other factor. Which is absurd on its face. You know, a bunch of kids in Gaza who were greenlighting the destruction of, literally, is not, that's not a threat to America's national security.
You know what they're up to. Those 11-year-olds. I don't feel safe around them.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, this goes back to, like, just, you know, a longstanding practice to kind of try and separate out foreign policy from the rest of politics, especially public opinion. But they don't even, they're like, proud of that separation in a way. It's like there should not be democratic input into the American empire, which, you know, we obviously disagree with, but that the Democratic Party and Biden and really the whole foreign policy establishment thinks of that as a virtue, as that there are elites that are controlling this stuff. The polling shouldn't have an effect on it, but of course it does, and that's the reason we have seen really anything, not just the polling, but the organization that has sprung up to oppose the war domestically has had an effect on the administration. It's not an effect that's anywhere near justice, but it is enough to get, you know, the I hate to laugh, but the cringe-inducing speech of Kamala Harris last week, where she's like, "We're having a cease. I am now calling for a ceasefire," and then hold for applause. Hold for applause. See if there's any more applause. Let that sink in. Just let people. Hopefully, they just clip that, her saying that. They share it on social media, and they don't watch the rest of the clip. Seems like the whole goal of the White House with that moment in that speech, but she says full ceasefire for 6 weeks. as is consistent with what's already being negotiated. So nothing new, really, and no actual promise to put teeth into any of the suggestions they're supposedly giving Israel. But this is hitting Biden. He is a little mad at himself, a person says, who's quoted. And sometimes his suggestions that he gets, they conflict with each other. So some advisors have told him that he should walk faster out of concern that his gait feeds impressions that he's too old. And yet the White House is sufficiently worried about him tripping. So he's been taken. Yeah. He started boarding Air Force One with a shorter staircase through the belly of the plane.
That's funny. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't either. I guess it's like traditionally that's part of the presidential imagery is them walking down that staircase and waving. And they've had to forego that just to get him from point A to point B without falling on his freaking face and breaking it. And they say he's mad at himself for not being more forceful with the staff. And, you know, as someone says, he's been successful for decades in Congress, became vice president and president. If you try to change that person, you're making a mistake. Let the president go out there and do his thing. He is doing his thing, and boy, is it not working. He's on track to lose, and, you know, I know we said that last time in 2020, and, you know, part of me hopes I'm wrong again, but just the polling in 2020 was different at this stage, and, you know, this came up in 2016 when people were saying, tripping over themselves in the sort of the Democratic Party mainstream to say that don't look at the polls. Don't look at the polls that say Hillary Clinton's going to lose to Donald Trump or the polls that say Bernie Sanders is going to beat Donald Trump because polls this early on don't matter. They don't actually predict the fall election. It was just amazing how all the people who starting around that time, but especially the year after, would be like the fact aficionados, the fact checkers, the believers in fact, separators of fact and fiction. You know, we need to seek out the truth. We can't, you know, accept fake news. All these people right. were so, you know, gave the appearance of being rigorous about factual analysis. They repeated that without actually checking it. And the only person who had any kind of like megaphone, which I remember Matt Karp writing an article where he actually looked into the historical record because it's not like this stuff is, you know, hidden away like at a basement of a church in Dublin. This is all readily available information. And he pointed out that the polls are actually pretty predictive in the spring when it comes to the fall. And the only time where that hasn't been the case in the past, like 20 years is 2004. Best 30 years. And in 2004, they're only off by like 2 or 3 points. So judging by historical trends, Biden's going to lose. Does that make it a fact? No, but they just are not taking this sufficiently seriously. And, you know, according to this article, Democratic officials overwhelmingly say that he needs an army of surrogates to spread the word that his record has improved American lives in concrete ways. And, you know, Biden is he's getting the work done. You're just not seeing him. And, you know, that's the problem is we don't have enough people pitching Biden, which is just flatly untrue. I don't, you know, that's everything on MSNBC right now, practically CNN too, basically. And it's, you know, it's a failure of communication is another thing they say. It's not about the actual policies themselves. It's kind of the Will Stancil argument. It's the media, basically. It's people, the people's sorting of information is distorting reality. if you will.
That's really stupid because, I mean, I feel like with like Trump as an opponent, it's more cut and dry than ever. People definitely know what side they're on. There isn't a lot of nuance, you know. It's not like a primary where you're like, you know, me versus Pete Buttigieg or whatever. And it's also like, I don't know, it's interesting. I've been thinking a lot about the TikTok ban still and how like what Will Stancil's big thing, the whatever the whoever the fuck he's speaking on behalf of about TikTok, what they want him to say through his little fucking megaphone is that the threat of TikTok is not just what the bill is about, which is like selling people's data to the Chinese government or whatever. He's trying to make it like a Cambridge Analytica thing and be like, this is a threat more dire than there has ever been in terms of like miscommunication. And he's been talking a lot about the supposed like frictionless nature of the TikTok experience. You know, if you want to believe something, then you can just look it up and there's just going to be like an echo chamber sort of endless situation with TikTok. And according to him, that's why it needs to be like outlawed, because it's dangerous information, you know, which is a real like intellectually cowardly sort of position to take. It's real dumb lib brain shit, in my opinion. Like, information can't hurt you, it's good, you know. And the world is not shaped by a bunch of just people out there convincing people one way or another, but he's an idealist, and that's like what he thinks. He thinks that everyone is dumb enough to where if enough people go around and just go like, you should vote for Trump, man, it's cool, then like people will just it'll becomes a trend, you know. And he also kind of reduces the left, everyone reduces the left to like, they're just a bunch of people in Brooklyn that are trying to be cool or whatever.
You know? Guilty.
Yeah, but unrelated.
Truly. Yeah, I mean, and I think the conclusion here that's it's hard to evade this is that Biden should drop out. If what Will Stancil is saying is that it's all vibes and the media has convinced people that Biden is bad when he's actually good, then someone else should be running. And you know, that's also relevant to this article, which I should mention. The way it opens is that Biden apparently just like cussed out a bunch of his staff because of that point about polling in Georgia and Michigan because of Gaza. He got furious that they even brought that up, which is just like, you're walking into the abyss, man. Do you not? I mean, it's just, I we're going to be talking about this till we're blue in the face. We already have, but like, why is he still running? If you accept,
I'm blue in the face because I celebrate St. Patrick's Day in a traditional manner.
You do blue face. That's what Blue Man Group was originally based on, actually. It was St. Patrick.
The G from Aladdin. It's a traditional Irish gin.
But, like, why, if you're going to cling to this position that foreign policy should be undemocratic, but and you accept that that's going to have consequences for your popularity, then why would you then keep insisting that you're the only one who can win, who can beat Trump, when the polls show otherwise? It's just like, yeah, head in the sand. Well, yeah, hopefully there will be merrier things to discuss on this topic in the weeks and months to come. But something sort of related to this that came up this week, the American Prospect had an expose on AIPAC talking points. Luke Goldstein got a hold of some notes from AIPAC. He went to their convention at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center, where I have had the distinct misfortune of being when I attended CPAC 4 years ago. One of the most dispiriting experiences of my life. I was there to make fun of people and got some good clips, but just the, this is for Redacted Tonight, but just the sheer amount of just like, I had never been around that many people who were, who I guess I knew that all of them were devoted to in every way possible, making the world a worse place. And like continuing just the downfall of anything decent or the foreclosure of anything good happening.
Yeah. Incredibly terrible vibes must be happening at like a nexus of a thing like that. Jamie was telling me about being at one of those like far right conventions one time and like watching Geert Wilder give a speech and saying it was like more extreme than like Hitler kind of shit, you know, like scary, scary shit getting all those people together.
Damn. Yeah.
Or at least it wasn't in the Gaylord Convention Center.
Yeah. Well, so they have now, AIPAC has a whole legislative packet, and they're trying to rationalize, justify the Gaza war, and they're steadfastly against conditioning any military aid. And they're pairing this with a critique, a strong condemnation of the ICJ and their investigation, which so far they've concluded that is a plausible genocide that's happening in Gaza. And they're using, Goldstein writes, the ongoing war and the threat from Hamas to call for further sanctions against Iran. So I don't know if this is like a distraction move or something else, but they seem to be getting a little nutty with it in their calculations. This could, they're basically trying to pull the U.S. into a regional war, which, you know, we've already bombed Yemen. That is, there is a serious risk that that could happen. And it just feels just very reckless, and it's hubristic at a time when they are losing credibility, right? 15 years ago, AIPAC was a pretty mainstream, normal, accepted PAC. You know, that was, they were a thought leader. Democrats, Republicans, anyone who ran for president had to kiss the ring, and now they are, I think even Biden is like keeping them at arm's length, but they even describe, they use the pamphlet to describe their, this phenomenon as a quote, multi-front threat, unquote. And this is a threat from seven different groups, not just in Gaza, but across Lebanon, Syria, Iran, Iraq. There's a quote, Iran and its terrorist proxies are waging war against the Jewish state, which is an even greater threat than Hamas. So the entire region is at war with Israel. There's a kind of a, and you probably have uncovered some of this in reading the Rashid Khalidi book about this is kind of baked into the Israeli mindset, is just the perpetual state of like paranoia. Everybody's out to get you because, you know, they're smack dab in the middle of a region where people have very different views, and you know, are many of the surrounding countries are have a bloody history with Israel and do not get along with them. Like they're enemies on all sides, and it seems like this is just maybe an unmasking of an attitude that's always been there.
Yeah, I think another thing that's going on here is like, I mean, for this entire like saga or whatever the fuck you want to call it, for since like the discourse began being a general thing in like American life in October, you know, there's been all these different ways for the media to try to do, or for the fucking government to try to do PR through the media and try to convince like liberals and conservatives in various different ways that we need to support Israel here. And like something I've noticed periodically talking to people who watch a lot of cable news and shit like that is that Iran's going to come up eventually. And part of that is like the like never ending Cold War Russia gate type stuff. The theory, I think it's going to get thrown around that maybe they're angling on like how to press really here is that like, it's to Putin's advantage kind of that, you know, that Iran fucking gets into it somehow. And that's how you can convince people also that like, that Palestinians aren't legitimately defending themselves because the weaponry they're getting has to come from somewhere. And yeah. It's coming from, wait a minute, someone who's motivated, you know, in a way that we you already have all this narrative stacked about fucking Putin and, you know, voting in the elections and stuff. It just ties into all this shit that people already all have all this like resentment and anxiety about.
Yeah,
related to other shit. I think it's like it's very clever and like kind of underhanded.
Right. And this is, you know, this is not a new tactic, specifically Iran, when Israel is in the news for bad reasons, which is most of the time it's in the news. But, you know, for killing civilians or something like that, this is a longstanding reflex to just point to Iran and say, look at them. But an interesting part of this was they are, you know, as I said, Biden is not seem to be embracing AIPAC this year, but they are also not embracing him, despite being a longtime donor and supporter of President Biden. Goldstein writes, AIPAC's talking point also goes on the attack against him for recent remarks that, however tepidly, indicate a shift in tone. He's distancing himself from Netanyahu, embracing the language of ceasefire, and more recently indicating a potential red line, which is Rafah. So if Israel invades Rafah, then supposedly, we'll see, Biden is going to maybe say more than one negative sentence about Israel. We'll see. So far, you know, they're complaining about how Biden is, and in the packet they have a section with a subhead that says, why is President Biden dictating to Israel how to fight this war? In the same packet, they're like demanding more money from Joe Biden for the war. And they're complaining that if he does have concerns about the conduct of the war, then you have to deliver those concerns privately, because public statements are unhelpful. If they show divergence, that's unhelpful, and that emboldens Hamas and Iran. So this all has to be, again, done in an undemocratic manner. It has to be done through private channels. The public of any country cannot really be engaged. It's leaders talking behind closed doors. But if they invade Rafah, then I don't know. I don't know what Biden would do. It's hard to imagine him doing anything that would stall the Israeli killing machine. That would, I could see maybe Democratic senators who traditionally have been very pro-Israel, some of them are now saying that we should conditionalize aid. Maybe there would be a call for that, but it kind of seems like Israel is playing chicken with Biden. They're like, if you're not going to play ball, if you're going to like cast us, you know, you're saying we shouldn't do this. Watch us. Are you really going to stop us? You're not going to stop us. Come on. And maybe that's what's going on. And, I don't want them to invade. But I don't know what it would take for Biden to like get them to scale back. Something I've been thinking about too is, you know, I approached this when the conflict began thinking that, like, I'm an American. Well, I've gone back and forth on this. Like, I'm an American. I'm not on being an American. I've always unfortunately been an American, but
allegedly
America has like an outsized role in funding and co-signing Israeli war crimes. If they didn't have us, I don't want to, you know, then jump to the conclusion that they would just, the project would collapse and they would have to stop the wars or anything like that. I think that can be like a US centric view. However, like the amount of weapons we give them and like funding and the fact of the UN Security Council, where it's like overwhelming votes that we're vetoing, that does make me question that. Maybe he does actually have the power to stop the war just with the snap of a finger, the signing of the movement of a pen. What do you think? I mean, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle.
Biden?
Yeah.
Does he have the power?
Or just to, like the United States in general, how much leverage do we actually have over Israel? Cause I don't want to like overstate that. I think there is a danger in thinking that the US is like, has the ability to just say, stop it. And then it would stop. And, you know, in all likelihood, Israel would just keep going and it would be very hard, to get them to collapse, as happened with South Africa. We had good relations with South Africa till the late 80s. And then, that was really the turning point is the U.S. turning against the apartheid government. But it still lasted a few years.
Well, I mean, I think that like maybe there's some danger. This is a real devil's advocate argument, though. This feels like some contrarian shit, because like what supporters of Israel and what Israel is going to tell you is that it's not that simple. And well, I guess what supporters of the American support of Israel are going to tell you is it's not that simple, and that we couldn't just flip a switch, cut off the fucking power to them, and then, you know, that would cause them to have to stop all at once, you know. But the United States being the steward of this or whatever, like the sponsor of this, is fundamentally a necessary component. You know, everything that in that fucking Rishi Tlaib book kind of lays that out over and over and over again. They needed the British and now they need us. And I mean, in theory, if the United States was to be consistent and it's like its proposed role as this, like, you know, the police of the world or whatever, then flipping the support off to Israel would kind of instantly resolve, or it would turn the natural outcome of that eventually, I think, is that we would have to consider Israel like an enemy and use our military to stop what they're doing in theory. We wouldn't, you know, we don't actually do that consistently around the world, but that's a situation where like, I think they would be forced to stop, as if like, I did have bigger military than them, you know, as we turn that into a US involved military conflict. I think that, no, I don't buy it. I mean, that's the thing that like people that support Biden say is like, oh, you can't ask him to like to publicly make all these statements because it would disrupt what he's actually doing behind the scenes or whatever. And that's just you're acting on faith there. If someone making that argument also doesn't know what he's doing behind the scenes, they just believe what he says, which is like believing that the Wizard of Oz is, you know, really the big hologram and not really the little guy in the box or whatever.
Right. No, he definitely could be. I don't buy that he's doing anything, that he's putting any pressure on Netanyahu. But if he were to do that, I mean, I would like to think that it could just stop. And that makes me even angrier at him. If that's true, but I think there's also a possibility that it wouldn't actually, it's something that he should do and that every country should do, but it's going to take a lot more time and pressure to actually end Israeli apartheid.
Israel reminds me of like someone who's like a dick, you know, and then but when like you are a dick back, they go, hey, hey, text me in private. Don't say that in public about me. And you go, but you did that to me, which is something I've had happen in my life quite a bit. And it's like you just notice the inconsistencies there. They're taking full advantage of the situation that the United States is like allowing them space for. It's almost, you could say, the fault of someone for not forgiving them all that space. Like they're just going to go to the exact fucking extent of the boundaries that are imposed on them.
Right. Well, speaking of dicks and contrarianism,
dicks,
I watched a nearly 5-hour debate with the world's biggest dick and contrarian, that's saying something, Destiny, Mr.
Oh, I call him Density.
Whoa.
That's my really good own of that guy.
I wish Norm had that one in up his sleeve.
Mr. Density.
He called him Mr. Benel, and then that became Benelli, and then Destiny's comeback was, okay, Finkelsteinberg.
This sucks. Both of them. Jesus Christ.
So I remember,
punch up.
I remember when this was announced, and for people who are not in the know, Finkelstein debated Destiny. That's honestly kind of a sidebar to the full debate, which I actually thought was pretty interesting. It was not just those two. On Finkelstein's side, there's Mouin Roubini, and on Destiny's side, there's Benny Morris, who's an Israeli historian, part of the New Historians, which was a phenomenon in Israel, where kind of, you know, baby boomer.
Terrible name. That's just you're rewriting history.
Well, I mean, so it's kind of fascinating because these guys were some of the first to say, to go into archives that have been like sealed off, some of which have been resealed off, and actually say that the Nakba happened and Israel has to acknowledge that. And that is true. And that's kind of what made them the quote new historians is that they
I see.
Yeah. It was kind of like, you know, it was around the same time when in the US we had what were called revisionist Westerns, I think. Which when you're revisionist, it sounds like someone's trying to change history, but they were actually trying to revise the telling.
If you're revising the revising of it.
Right.
So it's like double negative.
Re-revising.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. You're actually going back to the original thing.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, you had Westerns like Little Big Man, which acknowledged maybe it doesn't totally hold up, but it does acknowledge the genocide of First Nations peoples in North America, as the new historians were starting to kind of do with Palestinians and the Nakba. However, he's kind of, you know, it's amazing to watch because he's somebody who is like somewhat honest about all of that information, that historical background, but then like weasels his way into being pro the state of Israel. And of course does the typical liberal thing of like, I don't like Netanyahu. That guy's a kook. But in general, his shtick is kind of, there was massive displacement. And this country was built on subjugation, but what are you going to do? You know, it's more or less what his thing is. So I remember when this thing was announced and at first, it seemed like it was just Fink and Destiny. And this was a couple months ago. And for a while, I was like, where is this? Is it going to be on YouTube? Because I like watching a debate. I'm not going to lie. I enjoy, you know, playing some Madden and putting the debate on in the background. I think the reason it took so long, as I soon discovered, is I remember this being announced like in February, it felt like, and they just finished filming it. They just wrapped a couple days ago. They were going at it for a month is basically what happened. I think, man, this thing was 5 hours. It was insanely long. And I think that was kind of to dispel what usually happens with debates is like, oh, we don't have enough time. We don't have enough time to get into that. I wish we had a much longer debate to go into that. And so this dude, Lex Fridman, who I don't really know who this guy was. He's like all over YouTube of just doing like really banal interviews where he apparently he even released a video saying, I don't challenge my guests and try to debate them because then that wouldn't be interesting. Then they wouldn't get to share their unfiltered perspective. Which, you know, is just kind of weak sauce, I think, for someone who's trying to position themselves as a interlocutor with the world's foremost intellectuals. But nonetheless, he had this debate, and it was a lot of historical background. I recommend it, honestly, if you want to learn about the history of the conflict in the region. Destiny doesn't say that much, ultimately. He's kind of, they all kind of can tell that he's an idiot. And if people don't know, Destiny is a streamer. He was really good at this video game, which I'm forgetting the name of, and somehow...
Is that where he came from? Was he was just good at a video game?
Yeah. What, is like Second Life or something like that?
They can't be Second Life.
game, Roller Coaster Tycoon.
Fortnite, Half-Life. Is it Roller Coaster Tycoon? That's crazy.
I don't know. That's the first video game that came to mind.
These are the references that you have in your pocket is what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
What
Harvest Moon, maybe it was that one. I don't know.
No. Solitaire. It was Solitaire.
Yeah. but he has managed to become a streaming sensation. He has people on and debates them, and then he says he wins all these debates, and the most frustrating thing of it all is he does have a loyal base of followers who will repeat the just crock that he wins any of these debates. I mean, sometimes he debates like conservatives and stuff. I'll give him that. But he had Omar Badar on a few months ago, and it was really painful watching this thing because he'll ask like one question and then he'll try to like throws like 20 facts at you, 17 of which are just false. And then, you know, the person he's debating will try to correct them one by one. And it'll be like, well, you didn't say about this thing. What about this thing? And just like continually, it's Mott and Bailey, you know, using a classic debate term. And he's like a master at that. And his delivery also, he is an extremely confident delivery. He talks incredibly fast. And throughout this debate, he's got like a tablet, and he has a fancy tablet with a tablet pen, and he's like scrolling through the tablet. And then he has a sheet of physical paper on the other side of him, and he's like going back and forth between these. It doesn't seem like he's actually doing anything. Like he has some random PDF that he downloaded, and then the other one, he's just drawing lines on a piece of paper to make it look like he's doing some smart guy stuff. Also his hand motions. He's a master of hand motions. Andrew Yang had this thing where he would like had like a hypnotizing motion with his hand, and Destiny has mastered that.
Well, that makes sense for Andrew Yang, because he was like trying to be a politician, and they all study like weird shit like that in terms of giving speeches. But the streamer is a newer, weirder phenomenon, and it's nothing good, I don't think.
Yeah. But he, I, it's amazing that anyone would say that he won this debate.
He's like a self-described neoliberal type guy. Yeah. He's against us and is a bad fucking person and has bad views. And for a long time, people were just like, why is this guy like this? Why is he such a dick? And then he sort of self-reported accidentally years ago that he's a full-on gusano and his like parents owned a fucking thing in Cuba or some shit. He's like directly from that lineage, and that's informing all of this.
Yeah. I mean, some clips have gone viral of him getting yelled at by Norm, who I've also had the misfortune of being yelled at. but he's like, you know, there's a clip. We were talking about kids being killed earlier. This to me was like game, set, match, this point in the debate. In which Destiny, you know, tried to retort to Norm bringing up kids being killed and was like, oh, well, that incident you're describing, that they were coming out of a facility that had been used for like military operations and stuff, and they weren't really civilians. And then Norm was like, it, you know, everyone's seen the clip by now, but like he's saying, you're so idiotic, it's embarrassing. And he pointed out that the wharf next to this shack had journalists, like scores of journalists, recording the incident, and it was a fisherman's shack. And this is a clearly propaganda that you're repeating. And then Destiny tries to change the subject to, you know, and that's what's maddening about it is he always will say like, oh, your facts are incorrect. Rarely does he like back that up, but he's just confidently will say that and then title the video like intellectual expert gets his facts wrong and then, you know, never actually cites what the fact is or does so deceptively. Yeah. But here he blatantly says something incorrect, which is that these kids were not civilians. And then instead of owning up to that, or at least defending the premise, he moves on to like, okay, well, so you think that the Israeli military, that they don't have like multiple people who there's like a chain of command. Don't you know there's a chain of command? And that doesn't prove his point. That proves Norm's point, which is that the chain of command is saying kill innocent people. It doesn't matter. Those orders are coming from on high, and it's a system of mindless killing and massacres. But that clip gets isolated. Of course, it's very funny, right? Norm calling him an idiot and roasting him for reading things on Wikipedia. But the Destiny defenders out there are just like, well, he has ad homs. He's using ad hominem attacks, and that's not a serious debate if he's using ad hominem attacks. So, you know, can't listen to him. Never mind the fact that you can make an ad hominem attack and then also make a factual point afterwards or before, right? There's nothing, if you say a mean thing about a person, that doesn't mean that ends the argument and that you've ceded all factual grounds for debate. It just means you also think that the guy is an idiot and he is wrong for X, Y, and Z reasons.
Is that what ad hominem means? You always hear debate nerds say that when you're like, you just call them something funny and they're like, ad hominem. Like, well, that is not, you're not technically debating me, sir, by calling me a Wang. You
know? Yeah.
It's like, no, I'm just calling you that because it was funny.
Well, yeah, it's supposed an ad hom is like it's about the person and not about what they're saying. You can have that.
You can do both.
But it's not an ad hom if you do both, because if it's an ad hominem, then it rests on the person and doesn't deal with the argument, which is not what happened. So yeah, we watched all 5 hours, my girlfriend and I, I will say.
Oh, steamy evening in the Lee household.
At one point she was like, this is my Super Bowl. She's into this sort of thing. So, but yeah, I don't know how anyone can walk away from that thinking that Destiny won. He's been smarting over it, and has been digging up dirt on our friend Norm. And
there's a lot of it.
There is a lot of it because he is, as we have explored, a very weird man, for understandable reasons. But some of the stuff they dig up is, I can't help but being slightly
ad hominem.
Charmed by it. Yes, this is an ad. Right, he's doing an ad hominem. He's not following up on the debate with any like research. He's just digging up like police reports regarding Norman Finkelstein. So there is a dispute. Norm got in with, and this is all like public at this point, I'm not, you know, spilling any tea. There's a dispute. Norm got in with one of his neighbors, people who live directly above him, and they made a big mistake by not.
I cannot imagine being neighbors with Norman Finkelstein.
I mean, he says most people in the building he gets along with, but I don't know how true that is. So they made a big mistake by taking on Norman Finkelstein. The subject of the email is, you've got 2 days to move or the troubles begin.
The troubles?
Yeah, I don't know if that's an Irish thing or... yeah. He said, I had 2 guests in my apartment, one of them a professor of criminology, which I cannot help but find that charming. This is, you know, maybe for familial reasons, because that this is like a quintessentially New York baby boomer thing to do, is just mention someone's credentials without it really being that relevant.
Yeah.
You know. Trump does that a lot. Like, someone's, you know, when he's talking about world leaders, top of their class, the best in their class, everyone knows they're the best. And Fink does that a lot too. Like, I know some of the best doctors in the city of New York. I went to high school with them. But just mentioning this guy as a criminologist for no reason. And then they listened to the noise for 4 hours. At midnight, we all went together to the police precinct where we spoke to several police officers, and the police are now fully informed about the situation. He also contacted Child Protection Services, spoke to several friends in the elevator on your way to that party at your place. I spoke to them about you. I now know your places of employment, which I will contact this week. But here's your big problem. And this is, you know, does not reflect, at first glance anyway, very well on Norm, unfortunately. He says, on Tuesday, August 18th, I will contact Immigration and Naturalization Services. I will inform them of, quote, young doctor Carol, the name is public, but I don't feel comfortable saying it. His neighbor's former quote unquote job at the fake quote unquote medical office next door, run by the Russian mafiosi fake quote unquote doctor. I know exactly what was really going on there. Faking a medical establishment in New York is a criminal offense and grounds for immediate deportation.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. You better be ready for an INS visit.
This is Norm?
This is Norm.
Wow, that's a little hypocritical.
Yeah. You now have 2 days to quickly and quietly vacate the apartment. I warned you in the last letter that I knew about the quote unquote illicit activity, and you chose to carry on like animals, all in bold. You will now pay the price. I warned you that you will never win against me. You should have Googled my name, in all caps, Norman Finkelstein, or gone to YouTube and entered my name. Now it is too late. So he also...
You shall know the name, Norman Finkelstein.
And then he also, like, was complaining about the kid being up to midnight, which... Like in saying he was going to call Child Protective Services because a, like, I don't know, 10-year-old was up until midnight, which I don't, that doesn't seem like grounds for confiscating a child, or
that's complete insanity, Norman.
Yeah. But then there's more, like, and it's not totally clear what happened. I kind of hope some journalist digs into it for number one, for a reason I'll get into in a second, but number one, because Norm got arrested, supposedly, according to this tweet thread, which I don't know how accurate it is, but he got arrested for banging on the pregnant woman's door, brandishing a knife and what appeared to be a gun. And then he got arrested, and there is a story in the court documents that these people dug up about him in jail, and he, out of protest, and it's not clear if it was from this incident that he got arrested or if it was related. He says it was related to something else. He got arrested in his underwear and refused to put on clothes. So he went to jail completely in his underwear, and he had to stand before a judge still in his underwear.
Well, who, Norm or the neighbor?
Norm.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I admire that. That is very, very ballsy. But I just want to round it out by saying,
I was up gooning. That's why I'm in my own. I just learned about gooning.
Yeah, it was revelatory, and he had to maybe try and do an experiment. But so I do want to round it out by saying, there's some speculation on Twitter that perhaps the illicit behavior his neighbors were engaged in was actually illicit. Maybe it was human trafficking. People have suggested this. And it's, you know, it's not totally out of the box. Maybe that really happened, that they're kidnapping people, that they are doing something very fucked up. I'm not a fan of deportations, but if they were, like, doing To Catch a Predator shit, then I don't know. Maybe he's got a point. But
that sounds like wishful thinking. I think it's been like demonstrated enough that Norman Finkelstein is a fucking lunatic. Like,
yeah,
there's no need to like to sanitize his image just because we support his abstract politics, you know?
Yeah.
I wouldn't hang out with Norman Finkelstein. It doesn't seem like a fun time.
Yeah. I mean, I probably shouldn't, but I would. And I have a soft spot in my heart for him, even though, yes, he is insane. And it doesn't bode well on Destiny to say all this stuff about how crazy this
does
guy
it
is.
All because he's after, about to get his ass deported by Norman Finkelstein back to Cuba.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if Norman Finkelstein is such a lunatic, well, guess what? You just lost a debate to a lunatic. So
yeah, that's also true.
Yeah, which, yeah, I think, I don't know. Yeah, again, I don't know how anybody can watch that thing and say that Destiny and Benny Morris won. Pretty decisive. They basically came down to, like, Destiny gave this soliloquy about how war is messy, civilians always die in war, and then quickly pivoted to, but Hamas is crazy, they're targeting civilians. And then, as they pointed out, double standard, buddy. It's, yeah, it's kind of a microcosm for this larger debate that society is having. And there's a growing consensus that maybe Israel isn't all it's cracked up to be, and should be rethought. But yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. As far as like who Destiny's fans are, you know, every once in a while in the wild, I will meet a guy who's like into Tim Pool or something like that. That like to people like us is like unfathomable. Like, how would you watch that and think that guy's fucking smart, you know?
Yeah.
And it usually seems like these people are just kids who just were living in the ether, in the like untethered sea of, you know, American like collective consciousness. They just sort of like, your life isn't political. It doesn't feel political. It is, but you can't connect like the dots and connect anything, any meaning to anything, you know, for massive crazy reasons, for, you know, Zizek reasons. We're in an alienated thing. We're in capitalist realism, yada, yada, yada. Right. And then like, they just get interested in someone explaining it in some way, and it turns into a fandom. And then, you know, once you like a person and you have sort of a relationship with like following their thing or watching and listening to it or whatever, it just becomes, your bias is inherent to that side, and you watch them like debate with other people and stuff, and you sort of like move from there, you know? And I like, when I was younger, I did that with a few things. There were just like podcasts and stuff I get really into, and like, you kind of know you're doing it a little bit too, but like, it doesn't really seem wrong. That's just, I think he's just got a bunch of people who he's the first person who explained the world to them, you know, and it fit probably some things that they already had biases towards. And you know, that's how you get a mass of people like that. And it just, it looks weird to us because up until this point, materially, the only way that was possible was through like media was gatekept, and you had to like establish yourself and then be, you know, sort of let into the system, and then it also shaped what you were allowed to say and stuff. But like, the internet just democratized media, created this new phenomenon that's like always been possible, but it just looks really weird. I think it's like kind of jarring and uncanny to a lot of people whose entire mind is trained on the old way of there being like systems of information and stuff, and political, you know, talk shows and stuff where they're only allowed to say certain shit. He's just an organically grown outgrowth of all this.
Yeah. And I think there's also an appeal to like, this is kind of like a concern troll of leftists in a way, which is appealing to people because, you know, like we're saying earlier about conservatives, they are trying to stop the world from being a better place. And the destinies of the world are doing a similar thing, except they're like, they're not as blatant about it. Or as steadfast, they're just kind of like, they listen to someone say, here's how the world could be a better place. And then they say, yeah, no, but it can't be. I don't think so. They're not necessarily like full-throated, like it shouldn't be like a conservative would.
Yeah.
But they are just, you know, skeptical. And they,
yeah,
they,
that's what makes him a neo-lib and not a conservative.
Right.
Things can't be better.
Yeah, and there's kind of a comfort in that for people to hear, because in all likelihood they're right, and that's the sad truth of it. But you still have to, if you are a moral human being, you have to fight for the world being a better place. You can't.
It's just weird. Feel, eh. It's that cynicism of like liberals. You know, it feels. When you're engaging in it, kind of like self-assuring, because you're right. You know, you get to feel like you're mature, and you get to look at people to the left of you as naive and childlike, and go, no, when you grow up, you understand that there are just civilian casualties of war, and war is necessary, and the president's always a war criminal. They just have these like weird platitudes they used to like to just solidify this. But it's actually inherently contradictory, I think, because a liberal will tell you that they want all of the things to be better, but they know that they can't be. And in order to like truly want things to be better, I think you have to try to make them better in spite of the fact that you might know that there's like a hopeless amount of shit working against you. That's the only way to get there.
Yeah.
You know, aim for the stars or whatever the fuck the fucking term is.
Right. And it also, you know, that as we all experienced in 2016, that can lead to calamity too. And, you know, you might as well, yeah, fight for what you want, you know. And we're headed for a similar catastrophe.
Oh, yeah, that motherfucker's going to win. Process it now so it doesn't feel crazy on election day. All right. Well, that was St. Patrick's Night 2014. Yeah. That's what I'm going to call this podcast.
That's a good name. Do you have any plugs? I have a plug.
Oh, yeah, go for it.
So if you're in New York City, Friday, April 5th, come on out to Paid Protest at Silo in Bushwick. This will not be just any paid protest. This is a special paid protest, which will be doubling as a roast of Eric Adams. We have some great comics, Millie Tamarez, Randall Otis, Ben Washerpin, Zubi Ahmed, Pedro Salinas, Matt Koff. People are going to be doing quick little roast sets, making fun of our disgraced mayor. And we're also going to have a rousing speech from State Senator Jabari Brisport, who's a NYC DSA member. It's going to be a lot of fun, and the proceeds are going to benefit the New York City DSA citywide budget campaign, which, of course, directly involves Eric Adams. So the money that we raise roasting Eric Adams will be going to fighting him on the political terrain. So please comment out to that. The ticket link will be in the show description.
Nice. I don't know. I probably got some shows coming up here in LA soon. I'll put them on my Twitter, maybe my website. But as for other than that, listen to my other podcast, Why You Mad? Me and Luisa Diaz talking art and philosophy and comedy shit. And my other one, King of the Hill, or my other podcast about King of the Hill. That's my podcast. I don't know you. It's about King of the Hill. It's that.
Can I also plug my other podcast, which I'm doing for the first time, last week was we plugged it hard, but now that it's fully out there, you can check out The Vanquished wherever you get podcasts, and sign up for our Patreon, because the first Patreon episode is going up this week. That's what this week's episode is going to be about, Barry Goldwater. And it's a really good interview I did with a really smart professor about that campaign and that weird dude. So patreon.com/The Vanquished.
Oh, yeah. Listen to The Vanquished. Great name. Okay, it's finished.
It's finished.